Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Outward, Slate's podcast about queer life, politics, culture, and this month, our month, anything else we damn well please. I'm Brian Lauder, an editor at Slate, and I just saw Grace Jones live for the first time last night, and she hula hooped for like two songs straight without stopping, and I'm not sure my pride is going to get any better than that, y'all. I think that's it. Well, maybe except for these Outward shows that we're doing, then that's shows plural that we have planned for you this month. As we mentioned back in May, throughout June, we're going to be bringing you three extra shorter Pride episodes each Wednesday, in addition to our usual big show on the 21st. Christina, Jules, and I each picked our own subjects and guests for these, and the lineup is very exciting, so definitely check your feeds regularly so you don't miss out. Before I get to this week's topic, I just wanted to give you a little reminder that we want to hear from you. That's right, you, the one being so cute and lovely listening to the best LGBTQ pod on the scene, about how you're celebrating Pride in this difficult year for queer and trans family. I know my focus is going to be on demanding my space in the world this Pride. Some of that's going to be through dancing with the gays, but I'll also be marching in the annual NYC Drag March, which is the kind of ultra-queer, unpermitted, space-claiming, glittery protest that I feel is really essential right now. We want to hear what you're doing, or maybe not doing, to celebrate or mourn or otherwise mark this Pride season. Send us a voice memo at outwardpodcast@slate.com, and we'll play a few on the big show later this month. All right, regular listeners will probably know that I'm one of those annoying gays in a thruple, or as we prefer to call it, a triad, and it's coming up on 6 years, but before and on top of that, I'm married to the partner I had first, something we did back in 2013 after DOMA was struck down with a lot of political ambivalence and primarily for health insurance reasons. Now we're thinking about what formalizing our current relationship would look like, and while obviously we can do whatever we want ceremonially, the government, as we've been told by a few kind but sort of shrugging lawyers, doesn't really offer much beyond forming an LLC, which isn't very romantic. I share all of that by way of explaining my keen interest in our guest today, John G. Culhane. John is a family law expert, professor, and beloved Slate contributor, and his new book, out in May from the University of California Press, is titled More Than Marriage, Forming Families After Marriage Equality. It's a fascinating tour of the legal statuses like domestic partnerships and civil unions that emerged on the way to marriage equality, and an eloquent argument for a more capacious sort of choose-your-own-adventure approach to family law that could accommodate the far wider and richer range of how people actually form family units and relationships of care in the modern world. Like, say, thruples, maybe. John, welcome to Outward. It's such a pleasure to have you here for Pride Month.
Oh, thanks. I'm so happy to be here.
So I think maybe just as a place to start, you know, obviously your work is in this area in family law, but can you tell us a little about the personal story of how you came to write this book? You know, why did you feel called to think about how the law deals in family arrangements and, as you title the book, argue for something, you know, more than marriage?
So I was very much involved in writing and thinking about the marriage equality movement for personal reasons as well as political reasons. So my husband and I entered into a civil union back in 2000 in Vermont, very shortly after that status became available. And at the time, I wrote an article criticizing it because I felt like what it really did was to kind of emphasize that really all civil union was, as opposed to marriage, was pure discrimination, in the sense that you were willing to give all of the benefits, rights, and obligations of marriage, but there was still this hesitancy about calling it marriage. And so it wasn't like they were coming up with good policy arguments against the unions of same-sex couples, which would at least would have been something something to debate. Instead, it was like, we concede all of that, but we still don't want to call you married. And I thought, well, this just really exposes that marriage has this kind of powerful social resonance that is so deeply rooted that even people that are willing to provide the rights and benefits aren't willing to call it marriage. And so as I started thinking about civil unions, and I wrote several law journal articles about civil unions, and actually some writing for Slate for kind of a broader audience on these same issues. And as I was thinking about it, I thought, well, you know, yeah, this is, it's important to get the rights and benefits, but, you know, we're leaving out all kinds of other people.
In the introduction, you sort of offer three problems that you see with marriage being the kind of end-all be-all of our current legal structure, or at least the way the law deals with families.
Right.
You
said
the first of which is, like, you put it, marriage is too bossy, which I think is a wonderful phrase. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, the idea of marriage being too bossy is, while it's true that people can enter into prenuptial agreements to get around some of the default rules of marriage, most couples don't, particularly most couples in first marriages. Prenuptial agreements are much more common for couples that have been married and want to safeguard their assets. Maybe they have children from previous marriage or relationship. But marriage, it creates all of these default rules. And we might question whether some of those really are kind of necessary. And, you know, in terms of what happens when the marriage dissolves, mostly the law is concerned with what happens when these relationships end. That's where that's where the principal interest is. So I think that's an area where I saw, real problems in that you have to sort of go out of your way to choose your own adventure if you're married. And not only that, but courts, for reasons I somewhat understand, are somewhat skeptical, depending on the state, are more or less skeptical of these prenuptial agreements. And the reason it's somewhat understandable is they tend to really penalize the economically weaker party. Mm-hmm. And the economically stronger party has kind of a big power advantage, right, over the other party in terms of even negotiating these things, and then just in terms of how they're negotiated, right? That's one of the big problems that I see, is that marriage, unlike other kinds of contracts people enter into, it's kind of shrink wrap, right? I mean, it basically tells you what you get and what you don't get.
Yeah, so you make this really interesting point, or you sort of invite us to look at the path of these other statuses like domestic partnerships and civil unions as almost like an unintentional laboratory of sorts for how we can think about other legal arrangements aside from marriage. You also call them at a certain point consolation prizes is one way, or that's right. What people thought about it, right? But maybe that's
right.
Not the right way. Before we get into the specifics of each one of those, give us just a little broad overview of that argument and how you sort of are maybe revisioning that path to marriage equality as something useful. Yeah.
You're quite right. I mean, they started life as a way to kind of incrementally gain the benefits of marriage. So when I talked to the couple from California, they had no illusions.
This is a domestic partnership.
Thank you. Yes. They had no illusions that they were going to be able to achieve marriage equality, right? They were working on a very small scale and they were interested in getting a specific benefit. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty radical in their politics and they were activists, but they were also very practical. And they had seen what had happened in states where people had actually challenged the marriage laws, and not only didn't they win, but they kind of went down in flames.
I think a lot of people may not know this, but people did actually try this in the 70s.
That's right, the early 70s, and it was in the wake of Stonewall when people were feeling like, and at least one couple did it as kind of an experiment in the deconstruction of marriage, but other couples were sort of more in the traditional mode of, this looks like inequality to us. But courts didn't even really have the vocabulary to understand. I mean, it was too far out of bounds, I think, for any courts to take seriously. And so, you know, these guys said, you know, what we really need is health benefits. So we're going to start small. And they came up with the term domestic partnership. And it wasn't completely out of the blue when they looked at a California Supreme Court case from just a few years earlier, the Marvin versus Marvin case, where the California Supreme Court became the first state court of last resort, state Supreme Court, to say, you know, even if a couple's not married, there are certain expectations that come from that. And the court was willing to recognize that under certain circumstances, either there was an implied agreement or maybe there were some equitable principles, like someone had gotten a benefit and the other person had, you know, had sort of done all this work that was uncompensated, right? There were these arguments about, you know, equity and fairness, and they were able to bring those, this couple was able to bring those to bear on their local city council. And it took a while, as they were telling me, they bored them to death. Every question they were presented with, they had a very practical, very common sense answer. And ultimately, you know, Berkeley became the first place to enact this. What's interesting from my perspective, or I hope from the perspective of the readers, which are soon to number in the millions, at first they were only concerned about couples that couldn't marry, about same-sex couples primarily. And by the time the measure was enacted, it also covered anyone, any couple, any adult couple, including couples that could have married. So right from the start, okay, you could see that what would become the marriage equality movement was already sort of expanding in ways that maybe even this couple didn't anticipate. And what I love about the domestic partnership experiment, and I think this is the best example of an experiment, is it started on the local level, and localities sort of were popping up all over the country like whack-a-moles that wouldn't be knocked down. They started springing up all over the place. And then there started to become statewide domestic partnership laws, which conferred in California, at least, only a small subset of the benefits, and then expanded over the years to allow more and more benefits, but were only available to gay couples or to straight couples where at least one person was over 62. And that had only to do with Social Security benefits, which I won't get into because your listeners don't deserve that. Oh, and then also, importantly, corporations started offering things that they call domestic partnerships. So you had it coming from the private sector as well, and they were all a little bit different. And some of them included opposite sex couples, some of them didn't. And so there was a whole plethora of different domestic partnership rules and statuses, and it was entirely possible for people to be in more than one of those at a time. That was out there, and right away you had this sort of creativity that was leading toward marriage equality, but was already kind of, it turned out the walls of that movement were maybe more permeable than people realized at the time. So that was interesting to me. And then civil unions were super interesting in the sense that these three couples in Vermont applied for marriage licenses. They were denied by the lower court. The Vermont Supreme Court takes up the opinion and unanimously decides that there's an inequity here. But the creative piece of it, which at the time I decried, but now I see as a brilliant compromise, was, you know, you have to give these couples all of the benefits of marriage. In fact, there's no other argument because we already have a state where same-sex couples can adopt, and we recognize they can be good parents and families. And, you know, in fact, the states that were more progressive, right, had less room to argue against it because their other laws were sort of all recognizing the, you know, the status and the ability of same-sex couples to succeed. But what they said was, but the legislature doesn't have to call it marriage. They can call it, you know, marriage with one R if they want. They can call it late for dinner. Whatever they want to do, they can do, but they have to give all the rights and benefits. And in one of the most sort of realpolitik things I've seen from a court, the Chief Justice who wrote the opinion said, you know, in Alaska and Hawaii, where courts ordered marriage, the consequence was a state constitutional amendment that overrode what the courts had done.
Right.
And the court was really concerned about that possibility and thought that giving it some other name might take some of the heat out of it. And they were quite right. I mean, there was a movement for a constitutional amendment, but you've got a pretty progressive state in Vermont. As John Stewart said, a state made entirely out of hemp fibers. So it happened in 2000. My now husband and I civilly united in 2000.
Let's pause here for a moment and take a short break. We'll be right back.
The new Starz series, Marianne George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Marianne George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually. This is one moment in the book where you write sort of personally about your experience. And you were an out-of-stater. I think you were living in Pennsylvania then as well.
That's right. Yes. In Philly, where I still am.
Yeah, right. So, you know, you're out-of-staters. You go up to Vermont. This does not extend at that point outside of the state. So why, I'd love to hear just a little bit about why you did that and how you're thinking about it sort of evolved over time.
I would say more than 90% of it was to get whatever state-approved recognition we could. And maybe it's the lawyer in me, right? Because sure. Who cares, right? I mean, you could just do a ceremonial thing in your backyard or whatever, like a lot of people did. But I sort of had come to see this as an important step. And only later did I think, oh, maybe my employer will recognize this and give health benefits and maybe some educational benefits to my family. At that time, we didn't have kids. And that is what happened. Within a year, my employer was actually pretty progressive and said, yeah, you know, these two are as committed as any married couple. But that's not what we were thinking. And I knew it wouldn't be portable. I mean, I recognized that. And in fact, it caused problems for a lot of people in the sense that if you were civilly united and then they removed the civil union status later, then what were you supposed to do if...
This happened a lot after marriage equality, right? Because a lot of states, you know, repealed those
that's right.
options.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Right. I knew a lesbian couple from New Jersey, which also had a civil union law. I went to their, you know, their reception. It was a lot of fun. There was much dancing. And a year later, one of them fell for somebody else, and she wanted to get the civil union dissolved. And it was unclear whether you could do that in New Jersey because they had a slightly different law at that point. And so they were told one of them would have to move to Vermont for 6 months. And I said, you know, that's A, that's crazy. And B,
yeah.
I bet New Jersey would dissolve your civil union because they were pretty progressive. And they did. But there were all these uncertainties around it because it wasn't marriage. It conferred all the state benefits,
right?
But none of the federal benefits. And that's still true, right? But at the time, and I have to do a little bit of a digression here, there was the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level, which basically meant there wouldn't be federal benefits for gay and lesbian couples, even if they were married within their state. So that actually provided some cover for the Vermont Supreme Court and the Vermont legislature to say we're equalizing the benefits, even though civil unions weren't marriage. Even marriage wasn't marriage for gay and lesbian couples. So that, in an talk about unintended consequences, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what happened there. And then the most important thing from my perspective is what happened in the state of Colorado, where they went through a three-step process.
Right.
So, and I had a nice long conversation with a state senator from Colorado, Pat Stedman, who was one of the architects of what became the designated beneficiary agreement.
I just have to say that, you know, that may sound sort of dull on its face, but your enthusiasm and excitement about this in the book is so palpable and infectious. And so I really want our listeners to pay attention to this, because it is, it's a pretty thrilling idea. And I had never heard of it before, before reading this. And you really think of it as, in some ways, the solution to a lot of the messiness and inequities of these earlier models. So please, tell us about Colorado.
Yeah, it's so exciting. So it's more exciting. Well, it's already exciting, but it's like, you know, triply exciting, thrice as exciting, I don't know, when we talk about what it could be, right? So Pat Stedman, the state senator, was responding to constitutional amendment in Colorado that prohibited same-sex marriage. These were all over the place, right? He looked with a couple of other people at different models for granting some of the rights and benefits of marriage, and things like the civil union, the domestic partnership, but also this weird creature out of Hawaii called the reciprocal beneficiary, which allowed people to, you know, designate someone else to get certain rights and benefits. And they cobbled together this creation called the Designated Beneficiary Agreement Law. And yes, it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but it's a fantastic idea. And what it does, so imagine going to a restaurant where everything is a la carte, right? And so there's a whole list of things on this menu. And any two people, unless they're married or in a civil union, which I'll get to in a minute, but any two adults, they can be related for that matter or not, can enter into one of these agreements. And what it does is it sets up a series of options. So, for example, one of the options is, do you want this person to have power of attorney for you, let's say when you become incapacitated? And I actually think about this also from a personal perspective. My mother is 89, and she is, luckily she's in great health physically and cognitively. She's doing wonderfully. But she might want me to have power of attorney when she becomes incapacitated.
Right.
But I wouldn't want her to have power of attorney for me. I would want my husband to have that and not her. That would make more sense. So the way it would work is she can check that off as something she wants to do. And in the other side, on the opposing column, I can check no. And it goes on like this, right?
Yeah, you have this great figure in the book where you can see this. It's literally just you initial, you know, one side or the other, like all the way down for all of
these. That's right. And it's all kinds of things like, you know, ability to access a bank account. And this can cause all kinds of problems. And in fact, you know, tragically, Pat Stedman's partner died not too long after this law went into effect. He had a very aggressive cancer. And he was able to go into the bank and just show them this agreement, which you file just like a marriage license or anything else. It's filed with the state and it has the same authority. And he said the bank didn't know what to do with it, and they called their lawyers. And he said, no, that's a thing. That's a real thing. You know, you should acknowledge that. And so there's a whole sort of list of things that you can do. The problem with it is, or the limitation, I should say, is that you can only be in one of these agreements, right? And if you are married or if you're in a civil union, which Colorado also did a civil union law subsequent to the designated beneficiary law, kind of on the way station to marriage, then those documents automatically supersede your designated beneficiary agreement. Well, why? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. So to go back to the example of my mom, yeah, I'm married to somebody else, but even whether I was married before this or after, I should be able to enter into this agreement with her. It would save a lot of money on estate planning documents, etc. And so as long as they're not inconsistent, and these days with electronic filing and cross-referencing, it would be easy to spot any inconsistencies and make sure that you had some mechanism for dealing with those. And the other thing is you should be able to be in more than one of them. So if I wasn't married, for instance, I might want someone to have power of attorney that's not my husband, or even if I was married for that matter, and why can't I enter into a separate agreement with that person? So I think it has tremendous potential.
It does. And looking at this from the perspective of someone in a three-person relationship, like that model would be so, like we have talked to lawyers about the various sort of things that we can do. And it is more than the LLC thing I was joking about, but there's not that much and it's very complicated and expensive. This would be such an easier way to go about arranging all of those very important things. And so it's really thrilling. If you know, I hope people will pick up the book to look at this because it is really exciting.
Thanks.
Stuff.
You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about the three or more person relationship situation because I'm very sympathetic to it. And, you know, I think at this point, the idea that the government would allow three people to marry in this same sense as two is very far off. And it has a lot to do with really practicalities like federal benefits and things like that. But that doesn't mean that people in these relationships should be ignored by the legal system. And there's all kinds of people that are ignored by the legal system. So one of the examples I use in the book is a gay man and a lesbian who years ago, they both decided they wanted to have kids. And so they had kids with each other, but they were still gay and lesbian. In fact, they said no one believed, at least their relatives didn't believe them. It's like, well, you're in this relationship and you have kids together. So obviously you're straight. It's like, no, really,
right.
I'm gay. But then what happened was, they got married because of the health benefits. She was, her name was Anne Quinn. She was staying home with the kids, working part-time or something, didn't have health benefits, right? And so they got married. And by the way, that's not what they wanted to do. And they said if there had been something like a civil union or domestic or something like this where they could designate the other person, one other person to receive health benefits, they would have done it. Then what happens is she meets a woman and they get into a relationship. And they had this agreement that they could do that. They didn't want to put that intimate side of their lives with another adult aside, right? But this third person, this woman was a school teacher. And so she was the one picking the kids up after school and doing their homework with them. And every single step of the way, she had to get all kinds of permission to like pick the kids up and do this and who are you? And again, this kind of a thing could really make that so much easier. You know, you could basically say this person has, you know, I give this person authority to, you know, deal with everyday decisions involving the children or something like that. And obviously that's a little more complicated because kids are involved, but you get the idea that there's a lot more that could be done in terms of recognizing and supporting these relationships.
Yeah, I mean, another...
Which exist, you know.
They exist,
that's
right.
That's what's important. It doesn't matter. You know, people are like, oh, this will destroy marriage. It's like, first of all, marriage is pretty resilient. And to the extent that it isn't, it's nothing to do with any of this, right?
Right.
And also, there's real people in real relationships that need legal structure.
There, I mean, another example that you give that I think is really striking is the sisters. The pseudonyms are April and May Doe that you give them, and they've lived together their entire lives, had a sort of complicated childhood where it sort of put them on a path to maybe being like this. We don't have to get into all of that, but like you detail that in the book, and they've made a life together where they care for each other, and that's what they've done. But of course, they're older now and they're coming to the end of their lives and looking at, you know, things like estate taxes and like all of the things that kind of come at end of life. Talk a bit about that example and how this designated beneficiary agreement might help them. You know?
Yeah, I found this to be the most interesting, and I think a lot of people that have read the book have found this to be the most maybe compelling story. And unfortunately, one of them has just passed away.
Oh, okay.
They spent their entire lives together. They never had any, one of them may have had a relationship with a guy for a while. But basically, in every respect except for the sexual one, they are intimate. And I interviewed them for a good long time in person, and you'd be hard pressed to find any couple, gay or straight or whatever, that was more kind of in sync. It was interesting because they talked a little bit about the Windsor case. And for listeners that are not familiar with that, that was the case that led to the Supreme Court declaring that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional. This was a relationship between two women. When one died, the other one had to pay millions of dollars in estate tax. Whereas if they had been legally married, there would have been no estate tax because of the spousal exemption. And so Edie Windsor brought a claim all the way to the Supreme Court and succeeded. And that's what got them to think about this. They said, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, they're married, two women. I guess because it was two women, it made them think this way. And we're not. And not that we want to get married, because we don't think that is the appropriate definition of our relationship, right? But there should be some analogous protection. I noted that in some states, if they were first cousins, they could marry, right? But not sisters. So the whole thing, there's a sort of an anomaly there that the law has really not dealt with in any kind of consistent way, or really at all. You know, you could say, I designate this person to receive the benefit of the estate tax exemption. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I think there are bigger problems with the estate tax exemption, but those are kind of separate and apart from what I'm discussing. They spent so much time and money trying to structure their legal relationship in a way that kind of mirrored marriage.
You're starting to get into this, but sort of in the final chapter of the book, you make this rousing case for a turbocharged approach to this that you would like to see sort of adopted nationally. Could you tell us a little bit about your sort of vision for that expanded turbocharged version?
Yeah, essentially the idea is you should be able to enter into as many of these agreements as makes sense for your life, you know, to the extent that any two of them are not inconsistent in particulars, which again, you could have a way of solving through, you know, through electronic cross-referencing.
Right.
And you shouldn't be disqualified just because you are, you know, married to another person. People are in all kinds of relationships. And it's kind of baffling why you would. It's not baffling at the time it was created. It made sense. But now I think it makes a lot more sense to kind of expand this. And the other piece of it is because family law is very much state by state, you'd want to create sort of a model piece of legislation. Then each state would adopt, maybe with some kind of modularity where there could be certain options a state would have. And then it would be kind of transportable, right, between the states. You know, right now, sort of marriage is the only status that's reliably portable. And I would hope that something like this would sort of follow in that vein.
Yeah. So that's about all the time we have for the conversation. Unfortunately, there is so much more in the book that we could talk about. But before you leave, John, we are asking all of our special guests this month to give our listeners a Pride agenda recommendation. So this is just like our usual updates to the gay agenda that our listeners know and love, but this is with seasonal Pride flair. So, John, what did you bring for us and our listeners today?
I wanted to talk just for a minute about drag and how much I really think that we should be supporting drag performers. So when my kids were little, we stayed at a bed and breakfast, and one of the guys who owned it had been this drag performer, and he put on this video for my kids, and they were like 5 or 6, and it was hilarious. And I think we sort of need to push back against this whole idea that, you know, drag is pernicious. And it really is sort of not even so indirectly part of this larger anti-trans agenda, right? One thing I wanted to recommend is, you know, if you go back to my favorite playwright, Shakespeare, I recommend to your audience, there are actually two versions of Twelfth Night playing right now in Philadelphia, two different theaters. And it is so basically, I don't know how he got away with this, but you could only have male actors at the time, right? So this male actor is playing a female who then dresses as a male in order to get through, right? And then at one point, the Duke that she's working for flirts with him, her, him, pretending it's a woman to sort of try out his lines. And you can't even keep it, no pun intended, you can't even keep it straight.
Right.
And that's what I think we should be celebrating. Go to a drag show, invite your friends, and just and have fun with it. And, you know, if you read some of these laws literally, you know, a 12th night would be banned. You couldn't have it at a public park where a child might see it, which is obviously blatantly unconstitutional, but they don't care. They're doing it for political reasons, and we need to push back. So that's my...
I love that.
That's my agenda.
That is a wonderful Pride agenda. I heartily second that, and I will be going to see a few drag shows myself this month. That's such a great note to leave it on. My guest has been John Culhane, and his book is titled More Than Marriage, Forming Families After Marriage Equality. It's worth a read, whatever kind of family you find yourself in this Pride season. John, thank you so, so much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
And that's it for this special Pride mini episode. As always, please send us feedback and topic ideas at outwardpodcast@slate.com, or you can hit us up on Facebook or Twitter at Slate Outward. Just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you will get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like The Waves and Working, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more about that, go to slate.com/outwardplus. June Thomas is our producer and the friend with portable benefits we should all aspire to be. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app. Definitely tell your friends about it. Consider it a Pride mission to tell your friends about it. It would make us so happy. And rate and review the show, of course, so that others can see how much you love it and find it. And again, please drop us a voice memo at outwardpodcast@slate.com to tell us how you'll be celebrating or maybe not celebrating or whatever you'll be doing for Pride in this really difficult year. We really, really want to hear your voices. We'll be back in your feeds with another special episode from us just as soon, as well as queer content from other Slate podcasts. So keep a close eye on those feeds. Until then, stay strong, stay gay, and happy Pride.